Hello and welcome. I'm Henry McKean and this is Under the Covers. Remember, you can tweet me. It's just at Henry McKean. So we're going to be at this time between 9 and 10 on a Sunday night from now on. So wherever you're listening, wherever you are in the country or perhaps abroad, you're very welcome. So a little later on in the programme, I sit down and I have an interview with comedy legend Monty Python, John Cleese. We're going to play it again, so stay tuned for that. And it's the full, unedited interview, and you have another chance to hear it.
I like the fact that I've made people laugh, and I think laughter's very good for us. Not just because it's so pleasurable at the time, but I think it relaxes us, it gives us a bit more of a sense of perspective, it gets us out of that sort of rather narrow, worrying frame of mind that so many of us are in these days, where you can't have a quiet moment without your iPhone going off or some other buzzing sound that means you've got to do something. You know, it's very hard to relax these days.
So, coming up on today's show, I spend the day with the Gardaí trying to get the capital moving and rescue someone with the AA.
We see people reading notes for meetings, women putting on makeup and...
Makeup. I sympathise with the commuters and I actually go on their commute with them for Are We There Yet?
When you come into West Dublin, where I do turn off for Liffey Valley, there is a traffic snarl there when you come under the bridge, yeah.
And comedy legend John Cleese tells me why he hates his mum.
It was all based in fear. She was frightened of almost everything, and therefore she had to have everything her own way.
So this week on News Talk, it was Are We There Yet? All week long. And the idea was to kind of feel the pain that you're feeling as a commuter in traffic as Ireland hits gridlock. According to Transport Infrastructure Ireland, if we don't do something about traffic on the M50 between the N4 and the N7 in West Dublin, it will be totally choked by 2023. In 2014, it was predicted by 2023 that just 143,000 motorists daily would take the M50 between the N4 and the N7. But we've already reached that. By 2016, it was 140,000. So a lot of anger and difficulty when it comes to even going a short distance. I met these commuters at various stages on their trip along the M50 on their way home.
An hour and a half sometimes to get home as well.
An hour and a half. So you've stopped and you've bought two bottles of red wine and obviously yes. You won't be drinking them until you arrive.
No, definitely not. sometimes you'd be tempted.
Coming from Tala out to the M1.
From the M50 to Tyrone. Yeah. That's a bit of a trek now.
That's a fair trek, alright.
And that's daily?
Daily, yeah.
So how long does it take you to get home in the evenings?
2.5 hours to 3 hours.
So anywhere between 2.5 and 3 hours.
Yeah.
I have to say, sir, I hope you don't mind, you look exhausted.
I feel it.
My young lad plays football for a team. It's 3 miles away. We can cycle in 20 minutes. If we take the car, it takes us half an hour.
So half an hour to go 3 miles, about 5 or 6 kilometres.
That's it, yeah. It's just traffic.
So it's really bad here in West Dublin.
It's quicker to cycle. We'll spend more time going to places than actually being in places.
There are a lot of cars with a single occupant in them. People will not leave junctions clear.
They don't leave the yellow box clear, do they?
No, never.
Parmistown, I reckon, is the worst. Getting on the motorway, to go on the motorway, it's ridiculous. You have to leave extra early for the airport. Once during the week, that's it, gridlocked. You're stuck there for hours.
You know, it does make for a stressful journey, even going to close locations, you know. Primary school, I'd do a lot of those kind of back roads. And if there's an incident, the whole place comes to a standstill. There's always crashes on the Nace Road. Emergency services everywhere every day.
The road tears in bits. I wouldn't even pay tax for it.
Well, I wouldn't say my whole life is around avoiding traffic. But yeah, I really dislike being stuck in the car. It's find an awful waste of time. So yeah.
So some frustrated commuters there trying to get home. But what can be done? Should we build an M60? I met William Lavelle, councillor for Lucan and chairman for the South County Council Transport Committee. He talks about quality of life being affected, construction of new homes and extensions to shopping centres being put off or delayed because of traffic problems. I met him outside Liffey Valley near the N4 and the M50 junction, one of the busiest bottlenecks in the country. He says we need to build new roads, we need to extend the Lewis to Lucan, we need an underground Dart, more buses and more investment. And basically he's saying there won't be any more extensions or new builds if we don't do something. Here is William Lavelle.
West Dublin has become ground zero for traffic congestion in Dublin. We've seen a lot of economic growth over the last 3 years. We've seen a lot more people back to work, and we're seeing that every day in terms of more cars on the roads. The M50 is just behind us. In 2016, last year, that hit about 140,000 cars per day. Back only 3 years ago, the NRA, the National Roads Authority, were predicting that traffic on this stretch of road would hit 143,000 by 2023. So we've had nearly 9 years' growth in 3 years. So the other side of us here is the N4. 100,000 cars, over 100,000, use this road every day. So that serves people commuting from Lucan, from North Kildare, even as far afield as Longford and Mullingar, who are coming up to Dublin every day to work and are either going into the city or trying to access the M50. That's in addition to all the traffic who use the road because it's a national road. So HGVs travelling down to the west of the country are coming up to Dublin, people travelling from down the country to come up to hospital appointments, the airport, and so on. We are boxed in here by two of the busiest national roads in the country. And as a result of that, and because of the fact they're so busy, you know, adjoining areas like Lucan, Palmerston, Clondalkin are finding it difficult to get onto the national roads. Since about last September, I think we've hit a tipping point. I don't think the road network can take any more traffic. We see increased gridlock, and it's not just at one junction, it's at every junction. The whole system has become choked at breaking point. If we don't invest in improving the transport infrastructure, it's bad for residents, it's bad for businesses, it's bad for future development.
So that was William Lavelle there talking to us. He's the councillor for Lucan and chairman for the South County Council Transport Committee. So I spent time travelling along that M50 stretch, and I went all the way up to the N1 to Applegreen Service Station in Lusk in North County Dublin. For many, they've been driving for a number of hours. They stop there before they get to Northern Ireland. They might have another 2 hours on their journey. I bumped into Michael Feeney from Applegreen, who tries to calm drivers. So when they walk through that front door, there's 5 food outlets, there's 250 parking spaces, there's a playground, and all walks of life of people use it. But people are angry when they walk in and they're venting their frustrations. I met these Christian motorbikers.
You know, the old service station of old, you'd be kind of in, drop your 20 euro note on the counter and run out the door, and you do get that kind of, but then, you know, they see when they come in, it's kind of a bit of a shock to the system, the size of the place and that, and so then they, you know, they browse, and you know, it's even like directional as to where the toilets, ATMs, all these facilities are, you know, so.
It's really hard to pass the city centre.
No, I don't like it, it's too jammed up the whole time.
So you're a Donegal man, you're trying to get from Dublin to Donegal.
Yeah.
And you stopped at the first hurdle, Lusk.
Yeah.
At Applegreen here. It keeps the kids settled. So you're going from Dublin Zoo to Newry.
So far so good. The kids are hungry, so we're stopping off getting them some food. No, so I find it whenever you don't have time pressures, it is a lot more enjoyable.
How's your rush hour going?
Slowly.
Slowly. And you've stopped here at Applegreen to get some chocolate to get you home.
To get petrol, more like it, to get me home. Looking at all these like Christian motorcycle groups.
Oh, you can't beat a Christian.
I was driving very slowly, trying to see what the white crosses were.
I'm Snowy from Warrington.
Snowy from Warrington. And you've got Holy Bible written on your denim jacket, and you've loads of biker badges.
I get used to it. It's just I like the driving, so I don't care. I just put up with it.
And being a Christian motorcyclist, does that make it a little bit easier because you can pray to God?
The biggest difference it means is that I stick to speed limits because that honours God. And I can pray for people who cut me up.
So commuters there, including Christian bikers, are talking to me about the major travel distances. I also got to speak to people on the N4 coming in from rural Longford, Athlone and Mayo. I met these people going long distance, and some of them actually got stuck in delays.
A road watch informed me that there was a broken down lorry in the Finglas exit, so that's where we stopped for about 20 minutes. I asked the question, where does the taxpayers' money go? You know,
the road in, say, County Roscommon could be improved a small bit, but we
just
have...
Just a tad,
yes. But we have a pretty good road all the way from Longford. It's pretty good now. When you come into West Dublin, where I do turn off for Liffey Valley, there is a traffic snarl there when you come under the bridge, yeah. It's traffic from all the way in there.
So where you live in Mayo, it's traffic-free compared to here in West Dublin, isn't it?
I live on a road that ends up at the lake, and I might meet a tractor or one car. That'd be it. I'd never have a traffic jam there, no.
Or maybe a cow.
No, no cows. They tie up their cows down there.
So there you go, that Mayo farmer admitting the only bit of traffic he sees is a tractor. So coming up after the break, We hear from the guards. I get in to a patrol car and we rescue a motorist with the AA. So welcome back to the programme. I'm Henry McKean and this is the new time under the covers. We're here until 10 o'clock this evening. And a bit later on in the programme, we're going to be speaking to John Cleese, so stay tuned for that. And before the break, we were talking about the issues with commuters. But what about the guards? What are they doing about it? How are they getting the city moving again? I spent time with them and the AA because they also are trying to rescue people. Take a listen.
My name is Sarah O'Neill. I'm a guard attached to the Traffic Corps in Dublin Castle and I've been there for about 7 years now.
My name is Garda McNaughton. I'm attached to the Traffic Corps in Dublin Castle and I've been in Dublin Castle since 1990. Certainly back in the 90s and prior to the 90s, traffic volumes were a lot less. Driver behaviour were a lot more sedate possibly. People are fighting for their positions on the road.
We're here in this Garda Jeep. Could you describe what we're in?
In Isuzu, it's the reason we have it is to police the M50 or to patrol the M50. We have compartments on the back that contain all of our equipment. We have lights, shovels, sweeping brush, tape, checkpoint signs, incident signs. It's like a little mobile Garda station, really. We have all the equipment we need to respond to something on the M50 in this car. You're liable to see absolutely anything on the M50, but I think for me, what's most frequent is minor traffic collisions, debris on the road, so unsecured loads on the back of trucks if something comes off, that causes the problem. Generally, drivers being distracted. We see people reading notes for meetings, women putting on makeup and... mobile phones, you know, just general distractions where people are so pressed for time that you now are trying to do this in your car while driving to work, and you know, then the road is unfortunately not getting your full attention.
Superintendent Thomas Murphy, DMR Traffic, Dublin Castle. We're here in the Traffic Nerve Centre in Harcourt Square. It's our main communications room that deals with traffic flow in and around Dublin City and County. Moving with technology and doing our best to police it from a high visibility point, rather than have guards on static points, we're able to monitor traffic flow from here in the nerve centre and then give guidance out to the public and to Gardaí directly to instance of concern or where there's snarl-ups.
Keith Fox, patrol for AA Ireland. It's just a great feeling when members do break down that they have the backup of the AA to make sure that they're back on the road again.
We're here at the AA bright yellow Ford Transit van that you see around the place and we have everything in the back. This is basically a moving mechanics workshop.
Bulbs, fuses, you know, you have your batteries, your booster pack, your jacks, everything for wheel changes, flat batteries for your typical breakdown scenario. When members do break down, if they are in bad form, by the time we arrive, they are very happy to see us and, you know, we make every effort to get the car back going again for them and give them the best advice for their repair. A child locked in the car with a dog, you know, that the parents are getting very anxious, but, you know, the key to that was calming the parents down. And once you got them calmed, the child calmed down and we were able to get into the car successfully and run away when the dog got out. Well, think logically. Make sure that you and your family are safe. Whoever's in the vehicle, make sure that you're not an obstruction to other road users. An ASAP job as soon as possible on the N7 just before Kill of a child that had a fever. The grandparents were bringing the child to hospital. The gentleman that was there had tried to do it himself. Didn't work out for him. There was a great feeling to know that you got them back on the road again.
Quick response there to by the emergency service to what looks like a three car collision there.
And you know, this really is cutting edge technology, and we're seeing the ambulance move that injured person to the ambulance, and we can watch this in real time, again without giving away too much personal detail. And we wish people in that accident the very best. And we're looking now at the camera angle of a huge tailback, so that one accident could cause a domino effect across the city.
In the camera room, we're able to advise straight away, put it out to on social media and the radio that there is a collision and to take avoidance routes or alternative routes.
And, you know, the ambulance is there first. They're still waiting for other emergency services, perhaps the fire brigade and the Gardaí.
No, there's a lot of pressure on the guys here in the room, and they do a very, very professional service here. It's 24 hours a day, manning the cameras. The public may not necessarily think that the Gardaí are around, but as you can see here, they're watching the roads at all times, and they're directing the mobile units to situations that they're uncovering here on the cameras.
You're taking risks, or you're manoeuvring your car where there isn't the space there just to get that, you know, car length ahead, or the vehicle up front who just did what he did. He indicated, moved out into a space that wasn't there, so he effectively created the space for himself, which caused the three cars behind him to brake. And you're relying on the vehicles behind you to be paying attention to avoid that collision. You've an advance warning for them for exits from 2 kilometres back, but people decide in the last 100 yards that they're taking the exit for the end zone.
Like that guy in a Nissan Qashqai decided just to pull out in front of you.
Decided that the last minute was the time to do that. You know, everybody is in such a hurry now, and it is that car length ahead, you know, it's all about fighting for your place on the road, you know.
Looking at this accident, it could be a mobile phone. Someone could have been on their phone.
Absolutely, we'd call that distraction driving, whether you're, you know, looking at your phone or your GPS or looking at a sign on the side of the road. Just not concentrating and driving will invariably lead to situations like you're looking at the screen here at the moment. So rural areas, there seems to be, for whatever reason, just a reluctance to use seatbelts. So.
A 10-car material damage accident on the M50. But on the occasion, I think one of the ladies who was a passenger at the time highlighted to her husband, one of the drivers, unsafe as he was just seemed to be distracted by his children. Possibly seconds later, that same vehicle collided with the side of her car. She was very annoyed, to say the least, like, you know, and I said, surely you should take issue with your husband also, because you highlighted to your husband that he was distracted, and yet he couldn't avoid having a collision with him, like, you know, or taking evasive action or stepping back a bit. Only a fool breaks the 2-second rule. Most road vehicles only have 2 or 3 car space between them there, and we're travelling at 100 kilometres per hour at the moment. There's a vehicle just moving in there on the left-hand side.
He just jumped lanes twice for no reason in front of a beginner.
He saw me, possibly, and he wanted to vacate the lane here. I'm moving up behind him. There's a learner driver here, a newly qualified driver here on our left-hand side. Obviously, he should be given a little bit more room than most other drivers. There's a white van travelling the outer lane. I could count it in feet, possibly, following at 100 kilometres per hour.
Yeah, he is tailgating.
What I would consider forcing him off the road, which he's just done. The vehicle into the front has moved in because he felt intimidated, possibly, by the white van.
Half an hour's delay on the M50 is approximately a €200,000 loss to the infrastructure, the capital. Irresponsible actions, the knock-on effect that will have on other drivers. Drivers slowing down, looking out, and one incident on the M50 where we had them slowing down and with their cameras, a fatal collision, and people taking photographs.
Of a fatal collision,
but that slows down the entire lane on the far side. Now, we prosecuted those people.
We have a lane closed, so the M50 is now operating on 2 lanes, and everybody in those 2 lanes decides to slow right down to see what's going on. A secondary collision has occurred, they're rubbernecking, everybody needs to see what's going on, as opposed to just paying attention and driving your vehicle and getting to wherever it is you need to go. Everyone slows down, everyone needs to see what's going on, and now we have a secondary collision. So we now have 2 lanes on the M50 blocked.
You have people cutting across 3 lanes. That has an impact on people behind them, where they're braking to allow them across, or they're indicating. So that effect, domino effect of brake lights coming on, and you add up the number of brakes and, you know, allow a second or 2 seconds for each car that brakes, and multiply that by the number of cars going by, and that's how your tailback starts to build up.
Becoming involved in a road rage situation, nobody does that, but you come out and everybody is busy and there's kids to be collected and dinners to be made and, you know, football training and all the other things that you know everybody has in their lives, and now we have an incident where there's a, you know, fender bender, minor incident in a lane on the M50, and it's now a 40 minute tailback, and you know people are frustrated by that.
We have a vehicle recognition technology here on board. As we drive along, there's no need to stop and check any particular vehicle. It's constantly running through the database of vehicles who have possibly omitted to pay to have their NCT performed, or taxed or untaxed and no insurance. So all these vehicles, including criminal activities, is popping up on screen as we go along, highlighting to us.
So we've got the siren on there. It's really loud.
It should be actually louder. Some people are oblivious to the fact that it could be on, like, you know, but probably you're driving along the motorway at 100 kilometres per hour. People really don't hear. Lights are always a huge advantage to us as well.
So there you go. A huge thank you there to the Garda Traffic Corps and also to Superintendent Thomas Murphy for making all of that happen, because we were looking at driver behaviour. And it's something as simple as that. Being in the wrong lane and even rubbernecking when you see a crash can delay everyone by hours. And also a huge thank you to the AA and Keith Fox for bringing me out in his patrol car. And actually going inside one of those yellow patrol cars, something I've always wanted to do with the AA since childhood. And also being in the big Garda car with the siren on and the flashing lights. It was amazing. We were able just to drive, obviously within the speed limit, and cars just disappeared out of our way like Skittles. Wow, it was exciting. Coming up next, John Cleese, one of the world's greatest living comedians, sits down with me, and I'm not sure why. But before that, here is a little bit of Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
Cheer up, Brian. You know what they say? Some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on! Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow.
So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show, keep them laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And
always look on the bright side. Always look on the right side of life.
Come on, Brian, cheer up.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the right side of life.
First things happen to see, you know.
Always look on the right side of life.
What are you going to lose? You know, you've come from nothing, you're going back to nothing. What are you lost? Nothing will come from nothing, you know what I say?
Oh,
cheer up, you old bugger. Give us a grin. There you are. See? The end of the film. Incidentally, this record's available in the foyer. Someone's got to live as well, you know? Who do you think pays for all this rubbish?
Always look on
the money back.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. I'm Henry McKean, and we're here until 10 o'clock. Whatever you're doing, maybe you're doing some ironing. Perhaps you're there driving across the nation, or maybe you're just hanging out beside the fire. So until 10 o'clock, it's going to be nothing but John Cleese, the world's greatest living comic. He had an autobiography out called So Anyway, and I got to sit down with him. And he's back in the news at the moment because it's been 40 years since he starred in 40 Towers. Could you imagine? 40 years, and he's returning to the BBC for a new sitcom. He's 77 years of age, and his character in this new sitcom, he's prone to outbursts, he's going to get angry, he has a love interest, quite similar to his character Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers. So I got to sit down with him and have a listen.
Hi, this is John Cleese. I'm sitting in my hotel room at the Shelburne Hotel here in Edinburgh, isn't it?
John, I'm Henry McKean, and you're actually in Dublin.
Oh, Dublin! Oh, yes, I knew it was someone like that. Yes.
So it's great to have, the honour to speak to you.
Indeed,
you
it is an honour.
A legend. And,
yes,
you know,
a legend. As you lie on your deathbed, this moment will flash before your eyes, and you'll think to yourself, at that moment, my life had real meaning.
And do you mind being called a legend? How do you feel about being called a legend?
I just feel puzzled. I don't know what people are talking about. I'm very, very happy that people say to me that I've made them laugh, because it's a very nice feeling when you make people laugh, whether it's at a dinner party or an ordinary party. You know, if you tell a joke and people laugh, it's a good feeling. And when I do that in front of lots of people, it's an even better feeling. I like the fact that I've made people laugh, and I think laughter's very good for us, not just because it's so pleasurable at the time, but I think it relaxes us, it gives us a bit more of a sense of perspective, it gets us out of that sort of rather narrow, worrying frame of mind that so many of us are in these days, where you can't have a quiet moment without your iPhone going off or some other buzzing sound that means you've got to do something. You know, it's very hard to relax these days.
It's so true, and you mentioned worry, and I know your mother worried a lot, and you had a difficult relationship with your mum, and you write about it in your book, and we've got lots and lots of copies all over the place here.
Yeah, I signed about 50 yesterday.
50?
Yeah. Oh, that's nothing. I signed 733 in Malvern 2 evenings ago.
Really?
Yeah.
And do you mind signing them?
Well, it's not the most exciting thing in the world, but what you do is you're chatting to the people who are helping you, because somebody gives you the book, you open at the right place, and as you're writing your name, you know someone else is ready to take the book away when you push it to the left. So you're having very interesting conversations with people. I'm learning a lot of stuff about the book trade, for example, which I didn't know. I didn't know that 90% of autobiographies are not written by the people.
Yeah, the ghostwriters.
Oh, yeah, 90%, though. Yeah, I mean, that's extraordinary.
It's huge, you know?
Yeah, and I didn't know that. But you mentioned my mother. Yes, she was a very neurotic woman and not one who was ever very happy or relaxed, although she had a wonderful black sense of humour.
You did, in a way, inherit something from your mum. I know you say that at times she could be very, very difficult, as she could be. She could be angry and she could be...
Well, she was a typically neurotic woman. It was all based in fear. She was frightened of almost everything. And therefore, she had to have everything her own way, because she couldn't bear it to be any other way. I mean, Dad once said to me, you know, that before they were married, they used to sleep with the window open. It's a very small thing, but I like the pettiness of it. After they were married, she always insisted the window had to be closed. Dad liked to have it open, but there was no negotiating, because she couldn't cope if it was open. You see, so people who can't cope have to control everyone around them to make sure they don't do anything they can't cope with.
And John Cleese, your mum, and then I suppose your wives, can I talk about your divorces? Is that okay for me to mention?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, and you talk about walking on eggshells and therapy, and how, because of your mum, you feel that maybe relationships didn't work out.
I think that's right, because I think, you know, almost any psychiatrist or therapist or whatever you want to call them will tell you that the mother's very, very important. I mean, the most confident people I've ever come across, quietly confident people, all seem to have had very good relationships with their mothers. Many of the most productive and most driven people don't seem to have had very good relationships with their mothers. It's though they're always trying to prove themselves.
My father texted me there and he said, you must ask John Cleese about all those customer service adverts, and will he be doing any more?
Oh, that's all right. You know, no, I mean, I've always tried to do interesting things. I'm not as entrepreneurial as I might be, I very much reacted to people's offers. People ask me to do things, and I either do them or I don't. Sometimes people say, well, why didn't you do that? And I said, I wasn't asked. Or they said, why did you do that? And I said, I was asked. And on this particular occasion, a man I liked and admired hugely called Tony Jay, who subsequently wrote Yes, Minister, and Yes, Prime Minister, he came to me after we'd worked together on the Frost Report, he was on the script side, and said that he wanted to make good training films to improve British business and that we could use humour, and was I interested? And I actually wanted to work with him. So I said yes, and we wrote, for 20 years we wrote and made these training films teaching people how to take decisions or run meetings or sell across the counter or put in a proposal, all that kind of thing. And I found them really interesting, and they were a nice small group of people. I'm still very close to a couple of them. And it's one of the happiest phases of my life. But it's not what you expect a comic to be doing. But I did it just because it seemed interesting.
And you mentioned being a comic. And I suppose back in Ireland at one point, The Life of Brian was banned. And also how comedy has changed. I watched a YouTube video just last night. And it was the Ministry of City Walks. And it was in Italian. And it had 7 million hits in Italian. Your humour seems to travel.
Yes, I know. And that was the thing that... Excuse me. That was the thing that surprised us most when the Pythons did the reunion shows at the O2 in July. We had no idea how international our appeal was. We knew that people in Canada and Australia liked it, and we knew that a lot of people in Northern Europe, Scandinavians, have the same sense of humour as the British and the Dutch. But we were astonished to find that, for example, so many Brazilians
like you.
And Japanese.
Japanese.
I know.
That's tough.
That's really extraordinary. Mm. And they're terrific fans, and they flew all the way to London to see those shows. So the very fact that our humour is so international is very pleasing. And what I discovered now, for example, the book is a sensation in Australia, and it's a sensation in Sweden. And now where's the... Oh, and in Canada.
They like it in Canada. It's
they love
okay
it.
Here. Well, it's doing well here.
Sorry. Oh, it's doing well. Okay here, yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, the book market here is difficult and is down on all fronts, but it's doing okay here. But it's fascinating for me that these are countries where they are already reprinting.
Spending all that time writing it and then going, delving into your past and openly talking about your life and telling the world, telling me, doing interviews across the globe And this is your only sit-down Irish radio interview, so it's an honour to be sitting beside you.
It is, John Cleese. It is. as I say, an unforgettable moment for you to illuminate your miserable little life.
Well, no, that's a pretty good life. Go easy there, John
I'm
Cleese.
Just trying to tease you into not being so reverend towards me.
Well, and we'll talk about that, being a risk-taker, and a little bit about how you say joining the BBC back then wasn't... The risk was becoming
right.
A lawyer. Tell us about that.
Well, the risk was to go into show business. That would have been regarded as very risky and almost insane, almost suicidal by the sort of people that I grew up with, these very lower middle class people, very smart, very diligent, very dignified, you know, very worried about their reputations, very hard-working, very decent people. But they would not expect you to do anything like go into show business. You'd be just as likely to become a matador as far as they were concerned. They expected you to manage a shop or be perhaps a bank manager or possibly a solicitor or something like that, an accountant. But the arts were simply not something that people from Weston-super-Mare went into. So it was very nice when I decided to go into show business and particularly to work with the BBC to be able to tell my parents that it was the BBC, because they sort of thought of that almost as a branch of the civil service.
Really?
Well, there was a pension plan, you see. It was stability. And that's what my father in particular...
And your dad was into that, wasn't he?
Oh, he was totally. He sold insurance all his life. And then he did it very well. He was an honourable guy who always treated his clients very honourably, and he got a good reputation with all the local bank managers and solicitors. So they used to recommend him to their clients.
And he did very well, and all the people in the First World War, he knew, the friends he made, might have signed up with him, and he did okay. And let's talk a little bit about that. I suppose your name, it was originally Cheese, and your father...
Name. Dad was born in 1893 in Bristol, and he was Reginald Francis Cheese, and his dad was John Edwin Cheese. And then when he went in the First World War in 1915, he changed the H to an L because he was fed up with being teased. It was as simple as that. So he was the first ever Cheese, and then I'm a Cheese. I only have daughters, not sons, so that name will die out eventually. And there are various Mrs. Cheeses around, none of whom, I think, still use my name. Even my current wife goes by her family name, Jennifer Wade. And this constantly puzzles hotels who find that I'm visiting with Jennifer Wade, and they always assume it's Mrs. Jennifer Wade, with the result that I finish up in these hotels being addressed as Mr. Wade. I don't know how we get to there, but it amuses me.
So there you go. That's myself and John Cheese sitting down having a chat. And we're going to hear more from John Cheese after the break. But remember, you can tweet me. It's just at Henry McKean. So straight after this short advert break, there's going to be more John Cheese. And you're very welcome back to the programme. I'm Henry McKean. And we're talking about John Cheese because he's back in the news again because he's decided to do another BBC sitcom 40 years after 40 Towers. So I sat down with him and I asked him, how does he get over, perhaps, his nerves?
I mind very little these days. I used to be much more, upset that the world was such an imperfect place. And now that I think I've really accepted beyond any doubt that the world we live in is impossible. I mean, it's just a joke.
It's a digital age, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but not that. I mean, just the whole idea that the people in charge know what they're doing, you know. You know, we're brought up to think that they do, and they clearly don't.
'Cause you're right about
I don't
that.
Blame them. It would just be nice if they realised that they had no idea. But, of course, if they realised that, they couldn't admit it to people. So we're caught up in an insane situation where people spend all their lives trying to get more money to buy a bigger car instead of wondering whether there's an afterlife.
And that's true. I mean, what do you think of that celebrity culture? And you write about that. Nobody really knows what they're doing. And the fact that you are a celebrity, you get mobbed sometimes wherever you go.
People get very enthusiastic and they get terribly anxious about whether they're going to get a photograph, which they're not, because I don't like that stuff about...
Yeah, you don't do photos.
I don't do photos unless there's a relationship with the person. For example, we've done an interview. If you wanted a photograph afterwards, I'd say, fine, we've done an interview. We have some sort of relationship. We've had dinner together, we were at a party, we've worked together, all that kind of thing. But when someone comes up to you in the street that you've never set eyes on before and says, can I have a photograph with you? I would ask any of the listeners to think, what would I say if a total stranger came up and said, can I have a photograph? Yeah. I don't have a relationship with them, I feel. And so I think it's kind of making light of having a photograph to commemorate a moment or a relationship with someone that was worth recording. But when people just come up the street, I tend to say sometimes, if I'm feeling a bit sarky, you know what, a photograph to commemorate the fact we met 3 seconds ago. You see what it's meaningless.
Strange, it?
Oh, it's more than strange. It's a celebrity culture, and I honestly think it's a very sad development. I think when I was younger, they used to interview people who had some idea what they were doing. You know what I mean. They were in the cabinet, or they might be a general or a senior judge, someone who's actually accomplished something. And now they're fascinated by the details, the private lives of people who are number three or number four in an American sitcom. And it makes no sense. The guys who sometimes are sex symbols, or the women, they, you know what I mean? They get cameras pushed in their face and people shoving. I don't get that. So I don't get mobbed. But, I mean, I do get a lot of people coming at me a lot of the time, most of whom desperately want a photograph or an autograph, which I'm always happy to do, provided there aren't 50 people coming at me on a zebra crossing. You know.
So have you heard of Mrs. Brown's Boys? It's an Irish comedy that's funded by the BBC and RTE.
Here it's very funny, but I haven't seen it, no.
And what do you think of the change in humour? And has your humour, has Monty Python, has all that stuff, and 40 Towers, which my parents love, and any time it's on the telly, I would stop what I'm doing and I'd watch, and it lasts the test of time. It's still funny. And even, like, Ministry of Silly Walks, when the receptionist comes in to give you coffee and it goes everywhere, the live audience weren't laughing that much at that, but I found that hilarious. So do you think, years on, humour's changed?
Yes, I think it does. I think it goes from one phase to another. I mean, that The Office, which was a superb series, but it was very much about almost making people cringe. You know what
it
I mean?
It was cringe.
Now, you could say the same to some extent about Basil Fawlty. There were some people who couldn't watch Fawlty Towers because, well, they found that he made them feel so embarrassed for him that they literally couldn't watch it. So you know, it's very hard to generalize on the whole. But I think you'll find that most people laughed more at the comedy that we were doing 30 years ago. And I think one of the reasons was we were just trying to be funny. And then there were whole new developments, apart from The Office, about in the 80s, there were lots of phony talk shows. Mrs. Merton and things like yes. that, or Barry Humphries, you know, A Day Madeline, where people came on to what looked like a talk show to be interviewed by a comedian in playing a personality. Mm. And I never quite understood what all that was about. It seemed to be a chance to take rather cheap shots at the people who came on as guests, and I could never understand why anybody would want to do
that.
Why
would they agree?
So I got puzzled by a lot of that. Every now and again I hear that there's a really good series, but I think the big problem at the moment is that at least at the BBC, there are a lot of people making decisions about what programs should be made who actually can't write, act, or direct comedy themselves, and that seems to me to be ridiculous.
So these are like middle management types who don't know what they're doing again.
Yes, they're called commissioning editors, and that they become famous because they've commissioned a program. You know, which is like famous for writing a letter or something. I mean, in my day, and there's always only a smallish proportion of people who really know what they're doing in any profession, but I work with people like John Howard Davis and Bobby Spears and Jimmy Gilbert, Ian Fordyce. These were directors who'd started on the floor as a floor manager and had worked their way up to being the top floor manager and then directing small programs for television. They really knew comedy. They'd worked for years with the two Ronnies. You know, a great friend of mine in America now, he lives there, directed the two Ronnies for years, and he went on to do Golden Girls and Third Rock from the Sun. But he'd done comedy all his life. And yet these executives know nothing about it, but they're making these decisions that are enormously important, first of all from the point of view of quality of programs, and also important to people's careers. And I don't think they know who has talent and who doesn't.
And for the public at home, who have no choice but to watch.
Well, that's right, and that's why, you know, I think the great thing about the BBC up to 20 years ago was that it made so many very good programs.
But you feel that's changed, and
like, yes, I do, and I think I don't know anyone who doesn't, so I'm not sort of a maverick out there putting this idea forward. I'm telling you what every taxi driver in London has told me in the last 20 years.
When did you realise that you were funny? When did you think, hang on a second, I can make people laugh?
I think I was about 9, and I do have a moment of clarity when I was waiting for the teacher to come into the room. I don't think I actually put this in the book. And I remembered making a forecast of his behavior that was a parody of a weather forecast on the television. And I remember the kids laughed. And that sticks in my mind. So I think it was a significant moment when I was aware that it was nice to make people laugh.
You talk about class structure and about your parents being upper middle class, lower class. I'm getting them muddled up, but the difference in the class structure.
Oh, that's a joke, yes. It's a joke about the minute differences in status between the lower middle class and the middle class. Do you see what I mean? Those kind of things mattered, with the result that my dad, who was just an insurance salesman, was regarded as an upstart by my mother's father because he was an auctioneer, and therefore, you know, it was sort of behaving rather as though he was an earl with a serf, you know. It was the class structure so permeated society, and to my surprise, it still seems to have much more of a grip on society in Britain than I ever thought it would, because in the 60s and 70s, we all thought that stuff was going to be history.
And John Cleese, I mean, you're 75? Are you 75?
Something like that. Nearly dead.
Anyway. And, you know, you're 75, 6 foot five. You've had an amazing career. Your career is still going. You're travelling the globe to promote this book. What's next for you? I mean, what are you going to do next?
Well, what I like doing best is writing, and I've always done that. But I've always thought writing is a much more demanding. If you named 20 funny actors, I would struggle to name five really funny writers. You see what I mean? There are very few. There's a guy called Richard Bean at the moment who wrote A Man and Two Governors, who wrote some of the funniest stuff I've seen for a long time. But by and large, there's always good actors out there, and there's quite good stand-up comics. But actual writers of comedy, they're very rare. In my entire life, I've only once been sent a script for a movie, for a major part, that was a wonderful piece of writing, and that was Clockwise, which was written by Michael Frayn. That's one wonderful script sent to me.
Brilliant movie.
In 50 years. Brilliant movie. One in 50 years.
Before I let you go, you've been to Ireland a few times. What do you think of Ireland?
I love the fact that there's a proper culture here. And just sitting in the dressing room or makeup room yesterday and chatting to some of the people there, there's a real sense that people know what it is to be Irish, and they're proud of that culture, proud of your literary tradition, you know, and your sporting tradition. And I like that because I feel I'm in Ireland. I feel so many places now becoming so cosmopolitan that they're really losing their own essential character. And just driving beside the Liffey yesterday in the car looking out, and I thought there were lots of pubs and bars and restaurants and shops that I would want to go in to because they were quirky, they were interesting, they had real character to them. They weren't just the usual, you know, what about high street chain stores.
Well, John Cleese, thank you so much for speaking to News Talk.
Not at all, and as I say, you will remember this at the moment when you pass on.
John Cleese, thank you so much. So there you go. That was myself and John Cleese. You could say the world's greatest living sitcom or even comedy comedian. Just an absolutely hilarious guy. But being there in his hotel room, just myself and himself, you know, it wasn't as I imagined, but still, I will always be able to talk about it. As John Cleese says, he's done so many interviews, he's been around the world, he's been involved in so many movies, comedies, you name it. He's a little bit difficult, a little bit spiky, but still incredibly funny. And that's it for Under the Covers this week. Until this time next week, you can hear more from me on Drive, and a huge thank you to my producer, Aidan McKelvey, and technician, Lee Duncan, and also a huge thank you to Neve Hassel that helped in the production of this programme.